The Navigators is an international, interdenominational Christian organization whose objective is to help fulfill Christ's commission to make disciples of all nations. They individually teach the basics of the Christian life to new believers, who then teach others. They work on campuses, military bases, and among lay men and women on every continent.
All right, let's go on then. One last thing, we talked about the causes, remember? Just to review those, what were they? What was the first one? Oh, come on, don't look at your notes. Come on, let's see how much you remember. Pride. Remember the verse? Proverbs 13:10. Only by pride comes contention. All right? Also, there was another passage there from James 4. Right. 1 through, I've forgotten, about 4. All right, what was the second cause? Self-centeredness. Good. And what was the passage? You remember? It's one that we know real well. Beautiful. Isaiah 53:6. Isaiah 53:6. It talks about we have turned everyone to his own way. Okay? What was the third one? Deceitfulness. And do you remember the verse? Again, a fairly well-known verse. Jeremiah 17:9. The heart is deceitful above all things and desperately wicked. Good. Those are the causes. Remember that the next time you have a conflict. Try to figure out which one of them is causing it at that point. All right, let's go on tonight. Let's try and figure out and see what God has to say on how to effectively terminate conflict. How to effectively terminate conflict. Now, I hope you noticed the wording of that. I said last night that it's important for us to realize that even though we use the word up here, resolving conflict, the Bible doesn't make that a point of emphasis. The Bible does give us guidelines on how to terminate a conflict, but not necessarily that every conflict is going to be resolved. And we'll explain that more in just a moment. But first of all, let's see. What's the first step we should take? There it is. Oh, yeah. Yeah. Start with myself. Start with myself. Acts 22:10 is one passage, and you remember what that is. That's where Paul is reviewing his testimony, and he makes two statements. In verse 8, he asks this question, "Who are you, Lord?" Remember, he's telling about the story on of what happened to him on the road to Damascus. Okay, and so the first question he asks in verse 8 of chapter 22 is, "Who are you, Lord?" And the second question is, "What do you want me to do?" And that's the first question we should ask in any conflict. Not, "If only my husband would do thus and so," or "If only my wife would do thus and so." Now, it may be necessary for them to alter their behavior. You may have a legitimate point in expressing yourself, but the real need is for me to be willing to start with myself and ask the Lord what He would have me to do, where I need to recognize steps that I must take in order to face personal responsibility. If you remember in Ephesians 4, 1 through 3, we looked at that quickly the other night. I'd like for you to look at it again just now. Ephesians 4, 1 through 3. Now, you remember what we said about this the other night. We gave a little outline of Ephesians, remember? And we said that the second section of Ephesians is the walk or the behavior of the Christian. And I suggested to you at that time that God has chosen to emphasize interpersonal relationships as the first thing He presents to us in our behavior or in our walk as Christians. How we get along with one another. In verse 3, look at it. He talks about striving to maintain the unity of the Spirit in the bonds of peace. That has to do with how we get along with each other. The unity of the Spirit in the bonds of peace. Now, that's what God wants to see. That's what His desire is. Now, go back to verse 2. And in verse 2, you have four characteristics that God says will produce some of this unity. And boy, they are, every one of them, they are bombshells. Any one of them will accomplish unbelievable progress in interpersonal relationships. Look at them for a moment. The first one is lowliness, or, to paraphrase that, humility. Humility. A humble spirit. That's what starts with me. That's where I'm willing to start with myself, not blame somebody else. A humble spirit. We talked about self-esteem. Self-esteem and humility are very, very parallel. You see, the opposite of humility is pride. Pride can manifest itself in two ways. It can manifest itself in exalting myself. It can also manifest itself in demeaning myself. That's still pride, because it's self-centered. See, that's all pride is. Pride is self-involvement, self-centeredness, comparing with somebody else. Either form is not pleasing to God. One says I'm better than God says I am. The other says I'm worse than God says I am. Both of them, God gets the short end of the stick. Pride is destructive for that very reason. Humility is the opposite of that. Humility doesn't compare or compete. Remember we said that in self-esteem? It simply accepts itself. He's not trying to be better than somebody else. But neither does he feel he has to demean himself before anybody else. That's why humility, put in that context, where Paul was led by the Spirit of God to set it, that's why it produces unity. Because there's no striving. I'm not comparing. I'm not competing. You follow what I'm saying? Yes or no?
Yes.
All right, good. The next quality is meekness. Meekness. And again, there's a great deal of misunderstanding regarding what meekness is. Meekness does not mean timidity. Somehow we have communicated, or we have gotten the idea that meekness is kind of a weak individual, a timid individual. Now, the reason I know that is not true is in Matthew 11, 28 through 30, Jesus said, "Come to me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. Take my yoke upon you and learn from me. For I am what? Meek and lowly of heart." These two qualities that Paul puts right in the beginning of chapter 4 of Ephesians. Lowliness and meekness. Jesus said, "I am meek and lowly of heart, and you shall find rest for your soul." By the way, we don't have time tonight, but let me encourage you to take Matthew 11, 28 through 30 and think about it with this in mind. Jesus is saying, if you're willing to come alongside and let me come alongside of you and get in the yoke together and we'll walk along the way together, you're going to learn two things about me. They are that I am meek and I am humble. Then he says this, and as you begin to learn those things, and you begin to experience them, you are going to find rest for your soul. Why? Again, because when there's real humility, there is no striving among ourselves, no comparing, no competing. Boy, you talk about something that brings quietness and peace. That does. Just to believe that I am just who God intended I should be, you'll find rest for your soul. Meekness. I looked up as best I could the references to try and find out a definition, and the closest I can get to the original text is a definition by Aristotle. And his definition was something like this: bringing our explosive impulses under control. That's what meekness is. Bringing our explosive impulses under control. And I would paraphrase that this way. Meekness is strength under control. Now, the beautiful illustration of this is 1 Peter 2, 21 and following. 1 Peter 2, 21 says that Jesus left us an example that we should follow in His steps. Okay? That's very clear. This is what He wants us to do. It's an example. It says that He did no wrong. That's the first thing. He did no wrong. Second statement, no guile was found on His lips. That is to say, there was no deceitfulness about Him. You could trust Him. He always told the truth. Then, it goes on and says, yet. When He suffered, He did not threaten. Remember that? When He was reviled, He did not revile in return. Now think about that for a moment. Jesus Christ, the Son of God, spotless, without blemish, no one could find anything wrong about Him, no guile was found on His lips, nothing that anybody could blame Him for, and yet when He was blamed, He didn't defend Himself. When He suffered, He didn't threaten. When He was reviled, He didn't revile in return. You talk about strength under control. And I came up with a definition from 1 Peter 2:21 and following there on meekness, my own definition. It's this: an unwillingness to retaliate. An unwillingness to retaliate even when I can justifiably do so. An unwillingness to retaliate even when I can justifiably do so. Jesus could have retaliated and done it justifiably. And He didn't. Why? Verse 23 is the answer. He trusted to God who judges justly. He believed God was in control, and when everything was all over with, the balances would be as God wanted them to be. Jesus believed that. You see, we're back to that thing we talked about earlier, our concept of God. Do I really believe that God is who He claims to be and that He'll do what He promised to do? Jesus did. And so it was no problem for Him not to retaliate, even though He could have done so justifiably. How often in our little conflicts, when we're accused of something, our first response is, yeah, you can say that. But what right do you have to say that to me when you, and whap? We retaliate. But see, meekness is an unwillingness to retaliate even when I can justifiably do so. Hey, you talk about something that's going to help foster good interpersonal relationships. That's a pretty good quality, eh? What are the rest of them? Well, the next one is patience there in 1 Ephesians 4 that you're looking at. Patience. We don't need to talk about patience. I think we all have a fairly good concept of what patience is because most of us don't experience it very much. We can define it, though. We know what it's supposed to be. And the fourth quality, and this one I want to stop with just a minute. The fourth quality is, depending on what Bible you have, forbearance or long-suffering. And in one version, and I like this paraphrase, it's a paraphrase, and I think it's the Living, though I'm not certain. It says, making allowance for the faults of others. That's really what forbearance is. Making allowance for the faults of others. One day, my daughter Sandy and our son-in-law Don are both avid lovers of animals. All kinds, every kind you can imagine. If it creeps or crawls, you know, they're friends. And so they've bought all kinds of books about animals of every kind. In fact, Sandy, they lived in New Mexico in a place called Silver City. Ever hear of Silver City? It's down in the southwest corner of New Mexico. You don't go there to go anywhere, you know, except to Silver City. And Don went down. He's a registered therapist in inhalation techniques. And he went down to set up a department for the hospital. So they lived there for about 3 years. Sandy got registered by the state as a game refuge. I mean, her yard did. And so in her backyard, she had all these pins and, you know, all kinds of, and they'd bring her wounded animals and wounded birds, and she would seek to nurse them back to health, and then they would turn them loose again or send them to zoos, as the case might be. And she had all kinds of things come there. I mean, really, it was beautiful to see. They'd get fawns and they'd get wild cats and everything. Owls, man, all kinds of owls and hawks. But one day we went down to visit them, and they had a golden eagle. That's like the kind that fly around here. It stood 30 inches high. It had an 8-foot wingspread. The talons were 5 inches long, these great big talons, you know. It had flown into a wire and injured its wing. And they weren't sure if they were going to be able to handle it or not, but they were. They had these great big leather gloves, and they'd go out there and feed it raw meat, and, you know, just it was kind of a spectacle. Well, they nursed the thing back to health and turned it out. One day they took a hood, hooded it, took it out in the wilderness, took the hood off, let it get used to light, and launched it. And that big old thing took off. And they said it was the most exciting thing to sit there and watch it just fly and soar until it literally disappeared, and to know that they'd had a part in it. Well, what I'm saying is they love that kind of thing. And one day, she and the boys, our two grandsons, were out in the backyard, and they found a robin's egg just lying on the grass. Apparently, Ma Robin just couldn't make it to the nest. And so... So Sandy got her book on robins. And she read all about robins and all the rest of it. And so she fixed this little deal up, a cotton nest, here was the egg, and a lamp so many inches above it with a thermometer alongside to keep the temperature at the right place. And they were going to try and watch this thing hatch. Well, unfortunately, about 2 days later, one of the boys got too curious. But when I got there, it was still in progress. And one of the boys took my hand. He said, "Grandpa, come and see." So I went up to see. And here was this beautiful little display that Sandy had fixed up. But the thing that caught my eye was a little 3x5 card that she had written on and tacked on the shelf in front of it. And what it said was this: "Shh, I'm happening. I'm happening." And I thought, that is neat. I'd like to have that this size that I could wear on me, so that every time somebody looks at me, they say, "Oh, I see, you're not finished yet. That's right, I'm happening." And you wear one, you see, and I look at you and I say, "Hey, you're still happening too." That's what that word forbearance means in Ephesians 4:2. Making allowance for the faults of others. You know, one of our problems is that we get disappointed when people act like human beings. Now, I understand that we can't continually make allowance for weaknesses if an individual isn't willing to face those weaknesses and try and work their way out of it. I realize that. You can't go to extremes. It's like acceptance and approval. Acceptance is real, but you don't accept someone, and that's where the hippie culture got off the track, where they went around demanding acceptance and saying that everybody had to love them no matter what they did. That's not true. You see, if your love is important to me, and your acceptance is important to me, then I am going to seek to be aware of whatever it is that offends you and try and make some changes. Acceptance demands responsibility both ways. So, forbearance demands responsibility both ways. From me, to be willing to forbear, and from you, to be willing to try and change and to work at making the changes that need to be made with the help of God in your life. But still in all, we have to remember, we're still happening. All right, so I start with myself. That's where we are. That took a long time, didn't it, to start with myself. And it usually does take a long time to start with myself. By the way, here's a good way to start. My favorite philosophers, the Snoopy strip. And this was a good one. Because this one talks about the very thing that I'm sharing with you right now. Here's Snoopy in his characteristic place of refuge on top of his little house. And she comes along and says, "I just don't understand you. You lead such a worthless life, you." And she starts to tell him, and he just leans over and gives her a big kiss on the nose. And then he says, "A kiss on the nose does much toward turning aside anger." And I put Proverbs 15:1. You know what Proverbs 15:1 says? A soft answer turns away wrath. A kiss on the nose turns away wrath. Now, it doesn't have to literally be on the nose. But the idea can be there. Florine is a remarkable woman. She really is. I was in Spain a year ago or something, and I saw a little ceramic doll that I thought, wow, I've got to have that because that's just reminds me of Florine. It's a little gal, and she's standing there with hands on her hips, looking up, just like that. Now, that's how Florine looks at me whenever she has something serious to say. She's 5'1", and she draws herself up to her full 5'1", and stands there and talks to me. And it's good for me. It really is good for me. Now, how often, and it embarrasses me to admit this, but it's true, so why should I be embarrassed? Many times when I start to get upset about something, she walks over and puts her arms around me and says, "That's okay, sweetheart, you can be upset." How can you be upset? Huh? Really? Try it sometime, you might like it. A soft answer turns away wrath. A soft answer turns away wrath. The second thing in effectively terminating is to risk confrontation. Ah, that is not easy. That is not easy. Risk confrontation. Most people don't want to take the risk. They say, "I don't want to get hurt. I don't want to get hurt." So what they do is they don't confront. They let it go. They let it go. And they think they've gotten away with it. But that hurt that they were afraid of will come to pass in a different way. Because that will fester, resentment will build up, that hurt will become deeper and deeper, and somewhere along the line, the lid is going to blow off. Yeah? You don't want to get hurt. But it's like the advertisement on the oil filter. You pay $4 now or $200 later. Same thing. You spend that emotional energy now and confront or have that crisis experience later on because you're not willing to confront. A couple of passages that we want to look at fairly carefully. Matthew 5, 23 and 24, and Matthew 18, 15. Matthew 5, 23 and 24, and Matthew 18, 15. Now, many of you are familiar with these two passages, but I want to review them with you anyway. Let's go over them. Matthew 5, 23 and 24 says this: "If you bring your gift to the altar, and there you remember that your brother has something against you," in this connotation, let's change that, all right? When you repeat that verse, you put in your wife or your husband, whichever. So let's say it that way. If you bring your gift to the altar, and there you remember that your wife or your husband has something against you. In other words, you have done something to offend them. Leave your gift at the altar. Go and be reconciled with your wife or your husband. And then come and offer your gift at the altar. That's what that says. Matthew 5, 23 and 24. Now, did you notice something? Did you notice that God says that reconciliation between two people is more important than an act of worship that we bring to Him? Did you notice that? Well, notice it, because that's what it says. Leave your gift at the altar and go and be reconciled with that person that you've offended, and then come and offer your gift at the altar. And how many times we've hurt our wife or our husband, and there's unconfronted conflict, and we go off and have our quiet time and think that everything is okay. God says, no way. No way. You leave that quiet time and you go find your husband or your wife and you get that thing taken care of and you reconcile with one another. And then you can come and have your quiet time. Then you can come and offer your gift at the altar. Matthew 18:15 gives us the other side of the coin. It says, if your brother offends you, in this case your husband or your wife, go and tell him so, or tell her so. If they listen to you, you have won your brother, your wife, your husband. And then it goes on to give specific instructions what to do in a church situation if they don't listen to you, to go back with witnesses and so on. But we're not talking about a church context or a congregation context. We're talking about interpersonal relationships. So we have the two phases here. One, I have offended. The other, I have been offended. Let's look at it. All right, here we go. Here I am. And here's Florine. All 5'1" of her. Okay? Now it says, if I have offended her, I am to go. That's Matthew 5. But Matthew 18 says, if I have offended her, she's to come and tell me so. Isn't that right? Isn't that what we just saw? Or if it's the other way around. If she has offended me, she is to come. And if she has offended me, I am to go tell her so. Now, what does that show me? It's always my move. No matter who. You see, that's what I meant yesterday. God isn't interested in who's to blame. He really doesn't care who's to blame. He said that's immaterial. You're to be moving toward one another. Always. Always. Now, you were saying something, and I want you to finish it. You started to say what? You'd meet halfway. Exactly. Okay? So, you meet halfway. And what, according to Matthew 5, is to be the result? Reconciliation. Right on. Reconciliation. Let's put that down. Reconciliation. Now, remember last night I said that's the key word that we want to think about? Thank you. Reconciliation. As opposed to resolution. Now, what's the difference? All right? Reconciliation deals with relationships. Resolution deals with issues. Reconciliation deals with relationships. Resolution deals with issues. Now note, please, the Bible talks about reconciliation, not resolution. Go and be reconciled with your brother. Reconciliation has to do with relationships, we said. Now what the Bible is telling us then, as I understand it, you can have a biblical relationship, you can be reconciled, you can be one in heart, there can be unity in your relationship, even though you may have a difference of opinion on some minor items. Notice I said minor, or non-essential. Unity demands agreement on essentials. But there can be many differences of opinion on non-essentials. Our problem is that we allow non-essentials to become essentials. Can you think of some? Let me hear you talk a few about non-essentials that we let become essential and lead us to conflict. Now, I don't mean that you should tell about anything you've done, but a friend that you know that allowed a non-essential to become an essential. All right? How you squeeze the toothpaste. That could be one. Florine and I got that figured out, by the way. She's a squeezer, and I'm a roller. And there was a time when I thought, good night, can't you roll the thing? And then I thought, really, that's not important. So I let her squeeze. And then I come in, and I carefully push it up, and I roll. See? And then for the next few days, she squeezes a little more. And I come along and I roll it. And we get along great. I roll, she squeezes, and we don't argue about it. What about some other non-essentials that can get out of perspective?
Cobwebs.
I see. Now, okay, we won't ask any questions about that. Well, they do add a certain character. Look at the positive side. They catch flies. What other little items? Yeah.
Like in a church situation, it might be what translation the Bible uses.
Right. That can become... That's right. That's the difference between unity and uniformity, insisting on some of these non-essentials. Right. What else? In interpersonal relationships. Yes.
Don't get your clothes dirty.
Yeah. I mean, you can't help but get them dirty if you wear them. Yeah. What brand of ketchup? Yeah. What kind of pillows? Right. Hard or soft, foam or feather, overstuffed or thin ones, Yeah. Well, yes. Pardon? Folding the newspaper. You like to have it folded, don't you? Yeah. And she likes to just kind of leave it spread out where she can see it easier. Yes. Back to the dirty clothes. Yeah. I had one wife come to me and say, how do you, because I'd said in one of my marriage seminars, try and think of something positive to say about one another. And after the meeting, she came up, I sat there and racked my brain, and I said, well, wait a minute, there must be something. Well, she said, no, and I really can't think of anything. She said, one thing that really bugs me is when he comes home, he starts kind of in the hallway, taking his clothes off, and they're just sort of like that. And I said, does he ever just drop them in a pile? Just dirty clothes in a pile in the middle of the floor? She says, yeah, and that bugs me worst of all. She said, because he could just as easy pick those up and put them over in the hamper. I said, but look, think of it. At least it's in a pile. You don't have to gather them from all over the house. It's a positive. Say, tell him that. Say, hey, great, that's great. Yeah, I'm glad you're leaving him in a pile. it's an amazing thing what a little compliment will do. Remember I told you the other night about holding a crown 2 inches above their head and helping them to grow into it? Huh? The other day, this was, a year ago maybe. No, not that long. A few months ago. For some reason, I took time to clean the sink out. The wash basin. And Florine has never bugged me about that. But when I But when I finished and I went downstairs for breakfast and she came up later and so on, she said, "Boy, sweetheart, that was beautiful." I said, "What?" She said, "The way you left the wash basin, it was just shiny." You know what I did the next morning? You're right. I cleaned the wash basin. And do you know what? I've been cleaning it every morning since. I really have. Well, this morning I didn't because I was late and I had an appointment. Yesterday morning. I had to get over for that early meeting. So I told her when I got back that evening, I said, "Sweetheart, I'm sorry I didn't get the basin clean this morning." "Oh," she said, "you don't have to clean it every day." No, but I know how much she appreciates it. She's never bugged me about it, but I know how much she appreciates that. That's holding a crown 2 inches above my head and helping me grow into it. That's right. Well, okay, we got the picture. A lot of non-essentials that we let get out of perspective. And we get issues before relationship. We worry about resolving every issue rather than concentrating on being reconciled and keeping our hearts together. God says that He wants us reconciled. He wants us being able to hold each other and to love one another and to pray together and to have that relationship that's warm and strong, even though there may be a few non-essentials about which we don't agree. Don't let them grow out of perspective. And you'll find, as we'll see in a moment, that many times by concentrating on the reconciliation, on the relationship, the issues take care of themselves. They really do. Now, we're going to talk next about forgiveness. Forgiveness. Because that's an essential part of terminating conflict. Ephesians 4:31 through 32 is a passage that says that we're to forgive as Christ, as God for Christ's sake has forgiven us. Remember that? That's a direct command from God. Forgiveness is not something we do because we feel like forgiving. Forgiveness is something we do because God says we should forgive. It is an act of the will. It is something we do in obedience to what God has said. Too often the human heart demands retribution. Recently, I was involved in a situation by no choice of my own. I attended a conference, and at that conference, someone came up and asked, in fact, they were introduced to me by a third party that was a friend of both of us. And my friend brought this person and said, they would like to talk with you. So I talked with them, found out that they had had a long-standing 16-year, hear that out, 16-year resentment against one of the other people at that conference. So after they told me the story, I went to the other individual involved in the conflict who was unaware of this completely. And I said, "You know, there's someone here, and last night they told me this, and I think the wise thing would be for you to get together with them and let this thing get straightened out." The next day, this individual agreed to it. So the next day, we agreed to meet in the room of that person. And I was going to sit there as sort of an arbiter to make sure that, you know, they stayed in the guidelines scripturally. As I took this person up who had told me about this 16-year conflict, we got out of the elevator, and they stood in the hallway literally trembling. And I said, "What's the problem? Are you afraid?" And they said, "No, I'm so mad. I just want to get in there, and I want to tell that person what I think, and I want to see them suffer the way I've suffered." And I stopped there in the hall, and I took that person by the shoulder, and I made them look me in the eye, and I said, "We will not move another step until you are willing to exhibit a spirit of forgiveness. I am not going to be a party to retribution. Now, either you make up your mind that that will be the basis on which we do it, or we're getting into that elevator and going downstairs and we'll forget the whole thing." And it was quite a confrontation. We stood there looking at each other for a while, and I was not going to back down. And eventually the person said, "You're right." And the thing worked out beautifully. It really did. Forgiveness. It is not something we do because we feel like it. It's something we do because we obey God. Because He has said we are to forgive one another. So, it's not based on feeling, but obedience. Also, it is given by the offended party. This person who was the offended party had to be willing to give the forgiveness before any kind of reconciliation could take place. It wasn't something that the other could demand. It's what the offended party must give. And it can be costly, as it says here. Luke 17, 3 through 6 is a passage I want us to look at to kind of wind up our time this afternoon or this evening. Luke 17, 3 through 6. Let me read it for you. Jesus is talking with His disciples. "Take heed to yourselves." May I recommend to you that any time you see a phrase like that in the Bible, that you do just that. That you stop right there and say, "All right, Lord," and you pray Psalm 139, 23 and 24. "Search me, O God, and know my heart. Try me and know my thoughts. See if there's any wicked way in me, and lead me in the way everlasting." Take heed to yourself. In other words, start with yourself. "If your brother sins, rebuke him." That is, rebuke doesn't mean clobbering, by the way. We think that. That's not what rebuke is. Rebuke can be very, very gentle. Very gentle. I learned with my children that they heard me far more effectively when I would stop, get down on the floor on my knees, take their face in my hands, make sure I had eye contact, hold it gently, and talk to them quietly. The rebuke didn't lose a bit of its impact, believe me. Rebuke doesn't have to be. But that's what we do. "Stop making so much noise." The child is usually so used to hearing the yelling, they don't even hear what's said. It's gone on so long, they don't even pay attention to it. But you stop, you make sure you have contact, and you talk to them. And it's amazing what gets through. So He says, rebuke him. If he sins against you, rebuke him. Let him know. If he repents, forgive him. And if he sins against you 7 times in a day, that's like once every hour on an 8-hour shift. 7 times in a day. And 7 times he says, "I'm sorry," he repents. You must forgive him. The apostle said to the Lord, "Lord, you've got to be kidding." Now listen, that's what they said. In their own terminology, that's what they were saying. See, what they were saying was this. Now look, Lord, if you really want us to do that, you're going to have to give us piles of faith to do that. We need something extra special to be forgiving. That's what they were saying. The Lord said, no, you don't. No, you don't. Do you know, he said to his disciples, and he says to us, do you know what you need to be forgiving? Just to believe that what I finished telling you a moment ago is the truth and do it. That's what he means when he says in the next phrase, if you had faith the size of a grain of mustard seed. That is to say, if you would just believe what I've just told you. If you would just do what I've just told you. It would be like saying to that mountain, be removed, and it would be removed. Now please consider this. In interpersonal relationships, Jesus is saying that the power of forgiveness will move mountains in a relationship. And we say like the disciples, oh, that's too hard. I need some extra grace. I need some extra help. I need to spend a half a day with the Lord to get the help I need to be forgiving. And Jesus says, no, 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 no. All you need to do is do what I just told you. Just forgive. Forgive. And it will surprise you. It will surprise you the mountains that will be removed in relationships if you forgive. Now that's what that passage is saying as I understand it. That's how important forgiveness is, and that's how important God says it is. Forgiveness. What about forgetting in forgiveness? Where does that fit? Forgetting. First of all, remember, forgetting may not be possible immediately. Don't be disturbed if you don't forget right away. You see, God has given us all very good memories. Good memories. And we all have hurts, and hurts last sometimes. So don't feel guilty and don't let the enemy accuse you because you can't forget immediately. Well, what do we do with that then? How does forgetting function? Just one or two suggestions. One, don't brood over the offense. Don't brood over it. The moment you remember the offense, remember also that you have forgiven. Don't let the offense ever come up without covering it immediately with an honest act of forgiveness each time. And you'll find that it will diminish in its importance. I don't know if I told you the story of a pastor that I talked with recently who had started a number of churches. Maybe I did mention this. And how he was still full of bitterness and resentment after 12 years. Because every time he told the story, he was brooding over the offense. He was reminding himself of how they had mistreated him. Brooding over the offense. So that's the first thing. Secondly, don't raise the issue again to that person or regarding that person when you think of them. Don't raise the issue again. Isaiah 43:25 says that God has taken our sins and He has forgiven them and He has put them behind His back never to be remembered against us again. Isaiah 43:25. So, don't hold that against that person. Don't raise the issue again. That's not always easy. I know that. I know that. But it's the only way that forgetting is going to be real in the act of forgiving. And then third, don't share the offense with a third party. Don't talk about it with a third party. Now, obviously, if it's a matter of seeking counsel from a reputed individual that you have confidence in and that you want to discuss the situation with, thank you, that's something different. You're going to them for that purpose. I'm talking about careless sharing of that information. And even then, I think it needs to be done with the knowledge of the person involved that you're seeking help or counsel or whatever from someone about that. But don't share it indiscriminately. That's what I'm talking about. Those are some of the suggestions on forgetting. One last thing, and I like this part. At the end of every conflict, there should be a celebration. When you get it all talked out and you get your hearts together and there's reconciliation, celebrate. However you feel like celebrating. Hug each other, kiss each other, do anything you want. Celebrate the fact that God has given you the resources to be reconciled, to work your way through conflicts, to experience the reality of forgiveness and the reality of love and the reality of enjoying one another in the Lord Jesus Christ. Celebrate. Sometimes I just grab Florine and dance around the floor. I don't know how to dance. I never learned. I wish I had. I'd love to dance with her. I don't think there's anything wrong with dancing with your wife. Ooh. I don't. She's my wife. But I never learned to do it. But I pick her up and swing her around when we celebrate a reconciliation. Maybe that's why she's having trouble with her back. I don't know. You see, there are two reasons to celebrate. You celebrate because it brings glory to God. A reconciliation always brings glory to God. Remember we said that Jesus came to reconcile. He came to reconcile us to God and to reconcile us to one another. And whenever there is reconciliation, it brings glory to God and we can celebrate. But not only that, we can celebrate because of the reality of the mutual love and development that God desires for us to enjoy in our relationships. And finally, to wind up our sessions, I want to put this back up here. Because I want you to go away remembering that. I want you to go away remembering that that is the need your husband has and your wife has and the people you want to try and reach for Jesus Christ have. That is the need that humans have. To be listened to be taken seriously, and to be understood. And the next time you start to have a conflict, just remember two things. Try and picture a little sign on your wife or your husband that says, "Shh, I'm happening." And second, they need to be listened to, taken seriously, and understood. Well, I really appreciate the opportunity of sharing this information with you. Thank you all. It's been fun being with you. And I just pray that the Lord will use this information in your lives and make your relationships just a lot more meaningful and more glorifying to Him. Thanks a whole lot.